but he was all over me in there. My head jerked forward as the driver threw the car into park. We were out front of another hotel bar, where we would grab some food and a drink to celebrate. Sean helped me out of the cab, which I found unnecessary. As the cab pulled away, I remarked on how disinterested, disgusted, really, our driver seemed about the White House. He must hate Obama or something. Then Sean smiled, and my heart sank. He told me that as the cab was rounding the corner to the Willard, he pointed me out, standing on the corner in my suit, and right before picking me up, told the driver that he was excited and a little nervous. I've never picked up a DC prostitute before. I had gone from the warehouse to the White House, yet I was still the butt of the joke. Chapter 2. In the Buffer. We are all on a highway to hell for all of eternity. Woman on megaphone outside the White House. Barack Obama burst into our office. He was pissed. I hadn't seen him like that. Heck, I hadn't seen him at all, not since I was an intern. To me, he was still the figure, from the news and forthcoming textbooks, from the clips I pulled by the thousands, whom I'd heard about in my Nana's kitchen and from strangers, no matter where on earth I traveled, the very embodiment of the globe's hope for the future. What in the hell is going on? Jimmy shot out of his seat the instant the president exploded in, grabbing Dan from his office. Mr. Pfeiffer, he exclaimed in a kind of whispered screech. Nobody ever called him Mr. Pfeiffer. The president was fuming over the ongoing payroll tax cut debate, which had gripped D.C. Most pundits agreed that Obama and the Democrats were on the correct side of this one, both in terms of policy, but also especially when it came to the optics. Democrats had proposed a tax increase on individuals making more than $1 million per year, while Republicans were allergic to a tax hike on the rich and preferred spending cuts. It was seen, like almost everything between Congress and the White House, as a proxy issue for the next election. Republicans were hesitant to allow POTUS a win as the 2012 campaign heated up. I didn't understand any of that when Obama erupted into our humble bullpen. I was brand new to the place. I had only just crossed West Executive Avenue in the West Wing. I half stood, nearly bowed. I hadn't thought to ask about the proper protocol, and then I noticed that nobody but Jimmy was on his or her feet. The West Wing was filled with a new cast of characters for me. Bobby sat in front of me. A former college football player, he was the kind of guy who was exceedingly cool from afar, but endearingly nerdy when you get to know him. He had a Clark Kent look, tall, square-jawed, trendy glasses, but his love of cats and photography made him feel more approachable. He volunteered during the 2008 Pennsylvania primary in the press office under Matt, who on his first day asked him to write a media advisory. An hour later, he still hadn't finished, so Matt asked him what was up. Bobby hesitated and then said, "So, what's a media advisory?" It wasn't quite so bad as me asking Matt what POTUS stood for while already working at the White House, but Bobby had come a long way from that moment. Hallie sat to my right. She was smart, fun, and because we both started in the West Wing on the same day, sympathetic toward me, a big sister type. Hallie began on the 2008 campaign as an unpaid fellow before graduating to a field organizer in North Carolina. She could talk with equal aplomb about red carpet fashion and issues of voting rights and gerrymandering. She was extremely open, and whenever possible, I tried to follow her lead. She and Bobby were doing their best to keep working, even as the president propped his hand on the back of Hallie's computer and laid down the law for Dan and Jay. I followed suit, sliding as quietly as I could back into my seat. Look busy, I thought, as I pulled up a Microsoft Word document and typed a variation on the same fake sentence over and over until the president cooled down. He wasn't screaming. He didn't need to. He was using his presidential privilege to make a point, raising his voice just a bit, crystal clear, message received. But to me, his words blurred together, sounding a bit like the adults in a Peanuts cartoon special whenever Charlie Brown is in the room. I hadn't been around him much yet. So far, my first week in the West Wing had been overshadowed by the birth of my first niece, Harry's daughter Aubrey, up in Philadelphia. Still, I sensed an odd joy in the president's contained outburst, a glint in his eyes, glad for the opportunity to loosen his tie and vent about Washington. I just hoped desperately that no reporters would amble in at this less-than-presidential moment. As a newly minted press wrangler, I was beginning to learn the ways of the West Wing, the White House press corps, and our little piece of real estate perched between the president and the press. I would spend my tenure in the West Wing here. We called it Upper Press, a small suite of shared desks between the James S. Brady Press Briefing Room and the Oval Office, about 30 feet from each, situated somewhere between historically remarkable and utterly regular. There are a series of four Norman Rockwell paintings that hang on the outer wall of Upper Press. Each frame depicts the scene in the White House waiting room, the West Wing lobby, in the early 1940s when Franklin D. Roosevelt was commander-in-chief. As you near the Oval Office, newsmen huddle with an administration official. Celebrities of the era hope for FaceTime with the president. Military leaders prepare their briefings. In the fourth and final painting, we see the door to the president crack open. Just as Rockwell's So You Want to See the President illustrates what it's like on the periphery of power, I was beginning to understand that my own story of proximity and history was just getting started, as, for the first time, millennials helped run the country. I was in frame, sort of, but I had a lot to learn. The first thing I gathered was that the reporters who came to the White House each day were free to enter our offices as they pleased. We were a kind of buffer zone between POTUS and the press. Now, the official meaning of buffer within the White House is the space between the president's stage and his audience, typically 6 to 10 feet deep, cordoned off by a bike rack or blue pipe and drape, and built into nearly every presidential event. During my time with the president, the area was filled with the press pool, Secret Service agents, and me. It's the angle from which photographers can get the hero shot, a from-below portrait of a president or candidate speaking from the podium. During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump often did not let reporters into the buffer because he was not comfortable with the way his chin looked when photographed from below. I doubt President Obama had an opinion one way or the other, but we in the Obama Communications Department, the folks tasked with thinking about such matters, loved that angle and photo. We were blessed with a handsome principal, which made our jobs, superficially at least, somewhat easier. So the buffer was important to us. And our place in the unofficial buffer of the West Wing was crucial. Just as we encouraged reporters to take up positions by the stage at events and rallies on the road, they often spilled into our workplaces in the West Wing without warning, which is why I was concerned that a journalist would walk in on POTUS as he hammered out his frustrations. To move beyond Upper Press, reporters needed explicit permission, and they required, and rarely received, an escort by a White House staffer. It all added to the complexity of an already bizarre place. The communications office and the press offices, known as Upper Press and Lower Press respectively, are situated directly between the president's office and the press corps' stomping grounds, equidistant, a sometimes fuzzy zone of its own that I was still getting used to as the president wrapped up his diatribe. I noticed Pete Souza, the president's photographer, snapping photos from down the narrow hall, capturing a few of the countless behind-the-scenes moments for which he would become famous. The best of the bunch were turned into jumbos, blown-up photos of President Obama hung throughout the West Wing and the EEOB. They switched them out every 2 weeks. There was always a new favorite to look at while walking from meeting to meeting. Initially, I was alarmed at the president's visit, but it turned quickly into something else. I felt honored to see Barack Obama this way. Gone was the polished politician smiling in front of an adoring crowd. Vanished was that silhouetted figure waving to a world that viewed him at best as a once-in-a-lifetime leader, or at worst, as a once-in-a-lifetime orator from Kenya. But most certainly not like he was that day in our office. At that moment, he was just a frustrated guy trying to get stuff done. This wasn't Shepard Fairey's iconic Hope Obama. This was something better. As quick as he came, he was gone. The president's visit set our room abuzz. Jay and Dan scurried into Jay's office. "I'll have Josh come up," Hallie said, picking up her phone. Josh Earnest was Jay's principal deputy, and almost certainly the next press secretary. He was like everybody's big brother, widely respected for his great hair, clean jokes, and dedication to the president. Josh always had a sense for how to handle the day's problem, no matter how big or small. I once had Josh edit a Yelp review I was thinking of posting about my car dealership. I suspect the president counted on him for slightly more pressing topics. Josh made his way up in moments and slipped into Jay's office. As Josh closed the door behind him, Jimmy sat down and exhaled a breath he'd seemingly been holding in for minutes. Bobby let out one of his catchphrases, "Whoa, doggy," and I closed my Word document. My perception of the president had been altered forever. Turns out I wasn't working for some sort of rhetorically gifted robot, naive as that notion may have been in the first place. I was learning that Barack Obama was something else entirely, something far more complicated and much more impressive. Joe Biden was what you would expect, in the best possible sense. On my very first day in the West Wing, somewhat lost, I watched as the vice president approached from down a narrow hall off the main lobby of the West Wing. I froze, a deer in headlights. Quickly, I turned to get out of his way, scooting through the large, dark wooden door to the lobby. I looked back. He was close now. Biden seemed to almost be saying something, but there was no way he was talking to me. He wasn't quite near enough that my holding the door wouldn't have been awkward. Plus, I thought he would be making a left to head down the stairs, not a right into the lobby with me. I continued. The door slammed behind me with a crack that echoed through the lobby. On the other side of the door, I heard as clear as day. What am I, talking to a door here? I was mortified. I did not want to get on Biden's bad side. You see, he reminded me a great deal of my own grandfather, my pop-pop, who is also a close talker and seems to know everyone, the de facto mayor no matter where he is. Like the vice president, pop-pop likes to grab your arm when he talks to you, quick with a quip, ready to route the conversation back to being Irish. Because of these similarities, or more likely in spite of them, Biden was on my Nana's shortlist of acceptable politicians. In fact, she loved him. Maybe more than my actual pop-pop, her husband. So I loved him too. It was hard not to. The vice president had a saying, one among many, but this was his most important, that his mother taught him. Nobody is better than you, but you're better than nobody. From what I saw, he lived that creed every day. From the way he gave the time of day to everybody, no matter his or her status, to the bathroom he chose to use. Sometimes I would end up at the urinal next to him in the West Wing basement lobby bathroom, a four-stall, two-urinal affair with low ceilings and white marble, one level below upper press in the Oval Office. Exiting that same bathroom one afternoon, I watched as President Obama, back from a political speech, sauntered down the hall. Suddenly, Biden burst into the basement lobby entrance, calling out, "Hey, boss!" He darted down the hall to catch him and put his arm on Obama's back. "That was great out there today." "Thanks, Joe. I had fun," the president responded as they rounded the corner together. This was years before the Obama-Biden memes took the internet by storm, but the Veep bounding down the hall after his boss was a meme come to life. It was a charming reminder of why people love the guy so much and why I hated offending him, especially on my first day. After slamming the door in his face, I did the only thing I could think of. I ran back to my half desk in upper press and emailed his press secretary to apologize. She said not to worry about it, that I'd get used to things like that. For an office space no more than 30 feet from the Oval, upper press is ordinary, uninspiring, and cramped. Composed of three offices, four desks out in the open, and nine people, things were tight. In the bullpen area where I sat for 5.5 years, I'm proud to say longer than anybody else in the Obama administration, there were four desks, two of which were shared, as well as a bastard of a printer, a fax machine that hadn't been used in years, and multiple TVs tuned permanently to the quad, a White House station that bombarded us simultaneously with CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and Bloomberg News. I would find that our office fit in with the rest of the West Wing, where square footage hardly squared with the complexity or the prominence of the place. Even as the need for more offices and additional personnel grew over the years, the building's footprint has remained stubbornly the same. It's a maze of narrow, jumbo-lined, windowless hallways connecting understated waiting areas to small offices and overcrowded conference rooms. Occasionally, older journalists would meander up our tight hall, taking full advantage of the fact that none of us had doors, and recount what notable people had sat where and when. They particularly liked to remind Hallie that she was sitting in Diane Sawyer's old seat, and that George Stephanopoulos was right here, and Rahm Emanuel over there. "I heard John F. Kennedy used to work over there, too," I wanted to say, while pointing toward the Oval. The office of the White House press secretary, which is one of the largest in the West Wing, is the exception to the cramped rule, featuring a couch, working fireplace, large desk, table, and chairs, as well as a wall of digital clocks displaying the current times and hotspots across the world, from Cairo to Moscow to Beijing to Jerusalem. That's where we gathered as a group for morning meetings, staff parties, and special occasions such as the State of the Union addresses, or to watch election returns. The Deputy Communications Director and the Communications Director each had significantly smaller offices. despite the fact that the communications director outranks the press secretary. At first, it was hard for me to tell where everybody ranked. All I knew was that everybody outranked me. Bobby and Matt often asked Dan if they were technically allowed to fire me. His answer normally depended on how the day was going, but "you're fired, Pat," became a familiar refrain around the West Wing. So, Dan was ultimately in charge, but in our world, it made more sense for the press secretary to occupy the bigger office, as he spent his mornings being briefed by between 4 and 8 deputies and assistants such as Amy Brundage, who before becoming a deputy communications director, was responsible for press about the economy, no small task in the early days of the Obama administration, and Ned Price, who was in charge of national security press. Matt and Bobby were a part of those pre-briefings too. They would volley mock questions back and forth in preparation for the daily press briefing just down the hall, through lower press and past the sliding blue door to the podium in the press briefing room. Lower press was the slightly grungier, though they would say the tougher, version of upper press. They had 3 offices too, but those doors slid, no hinge. In the winter, their heater never worked, and in the summer, mosquitoes loved lower press. Those who sat there were beholden to a large, automatic sliding door that opened to another automatic door that swung open to the colonnade, known mostly for famous photos of American presidents walking with leaders from around the world discussing affairs of state. It's a grand, stately walkway befitting the business that gets done on it. But when the president departed from or returned to the South Lawn via Marine One, the colonnade was also the corridor for the fuel fumes that wafted from the helicopter up the colonnade and into lower press, swamping the 8 or so staffers in its stench. In the past, lower press had been described in the media as a kind of frat house, a young men's club. But by the time I moved over to upper press from the EEOB, the gender balance had roughly equaled out in our sister office down the hall. Josh and Amy, 2 of Jay's most crucial deputies, had offices there. Matt, the Matt who knew me as the guy who loved Justin Bieber and didn't know what a POTUS was, had moved in. Marie and Antoinette, yes, these are their real names, sat next to each other as you descended into lower press. Marie, Antoinette, and I had started as interns and fortuitously made our way over to the West Wing. Antoinette, from the Bronx, was often affectionately referred to as a wise Latina, and sometimes as a saucy Latina by her colleagues. I knew her as the staffer who understood how to work the system. If you needed something accomplished, from better food at the mess to better press for the president, Antoinette wasn't going to let anything get in the way of getting it done. She ended every day with a non-ironic pronouncement: "It's been a pleasure serving the American people with you today." Marie, the pride of Cranston, Rhode Island, was a whip-smart Duke University graduate with a hummus obsession and a, perhaps related, perennial stomachache. We would become wrangling partners for the 2012 campaign, traveling together on each trip for every stump speech, OTR, on the run or unannounced, stop, or closed press fundraiser. She was beloved around the White House and among the press. Reporters had to do their best not to groan audibly when they'd learn that I was their minder instead of Marie. Jimmy made the quick trip down the ramp from upper to lower press often, because they had the lower-tech printer that was more suitable for reprinting Dan's ever-evolving schedule card. After POTUS's visit, Dan's day was blowing up, and a reprint was in order. Dan and Jimmy shared an archetypal boss-assistant relationship in the West Wing. Like so many West Wing duos, theirs was a bond built on shared anxiety, mutual fear, and, ultimately, friendship. Most assistants in the West Wing last roughly 18 months to 2 years before they move on. As the third year starts, a psychological wall seems to come down. Frustrations once manifested in hushed whispers and hidden eye rolls come to light through slammed phones and abrupt exits. Scheduling changes are taken as a personal affront, and adjustments made only begrudgingly. For the most part, White House senior staffers did a good job of recognizing the wall and doing right by their assistants, promoting them internally or throwing their considerable weight behind their candidacy for an external gig. Dan had seen that I was at that point on West Exec. He used to say often that it was important to take care of the junior staff, to prevent a coup. It was getting to such a point for Jimmy too, though he did his best to hide it. Jimmy, who seemed always to have a sense for trajectory, related a story to us once. He was 11, and upon completing the school year, he approached his subpar teacher, pencil case surely in hand, and said, "The most just thing to come out of this year is the fact that I will move on and you will stay here." Suffice it to say, Jimmy was struggling to rein in rampant frustration at this point, in his seemingly stagnant tenure. Smart and driven as he was, Jimmy was ready to put his talents to more substantive use than scheduling, no matter how important that scheduling may have been. He tried to cover. He was as chirpy and cheerful on the outside as he was infuriated and foiled on the inside. Back from lower press, he settled into a seat, largely hidden behind his massive computer screen. Trying to dust off his irritation at yet another reprint, he asked, "How was your weekend?" and began reorienting his mug of razor-sharp pencils. Jimmy never used the number twos, but apparently the chief of staff had once said that those with sharpened pencils were to be taken note of. Jimmy had dozens. "Oh, it was pretty good, thanks," I replied without volleying the question back to him. Not because I was rude, but because I already had a pretty good idea of how his weekend had been. As I delivered my canned response, I teed up an email to some coworkers. The subject line contained only a period, a part of the language of the West Wing. It conveyed that the body of the email was going to be snarky, and best not to be open in front of others. Into the body of the note, I typed, "It's Tuesday." Yes, Jimmy had a habit of continuing to ask how your weekend was well into the week. Late Wednesday afternoon remains his official record. Rumors swirl that the question was posed mid-morning on a Thursday once, but that's something I can neither confirm nor deny. I thought better of sending the note, what with the Presidential Records Act mandating that work emails be stored and eventually released publicly. It can be easy, even for the most earnest employee, to forget when chained to a desk 15 hours per day that said desk occupies some of the most valuable real estate in the world. It happened to me, it happened to everybody. That's why visits from the president, even when he was pissed, were so vital. They provided a kick in the pants, a reminder of where we were and why. "Got any snacks?" Pete Souza bellowed from down the hall, camera in hand. We always had treats because reporters were constantly dropping them off. They tended to pile up on top of the fax machine that never got used. Cupcakes, donuts, rum cake, cookies, and the like. The holidays were the best, or some would say the worst, when we would be showered with chocolates. The Russian reporter used to bring vodka. One time he brought a bottle with Barack Obama's face on it. Hallie asked if we ought to get it swept for listening devices. Jay, who'd worked as a reporter for Time magazine in Russia, burst out cackling. Where would they hide a bug in vodka? I laughed, thinking of the Russians listening in. This was a few years before we realized just how active the Russians aimed to be at our highest levels of government. One of our favorite photographers, Doug, brought his famous pretzels with Hershey's Kisses baked right in. Word spread quickly through the West Wing when the pretzels were in play. "These don't have nuts, right?" Pete tried to confirm as he grazed through piles of boxes containing chocolates and candies. He popped a piece in his mouth and headed for the hallway. "I love it when he gets fired up like that," he said with a sly smile, referencing the president's earlier flare-up. As Pete exited, Brian, the director of Oval Office Operations, swung through the door to our office, the one that connects to the hallway outside of the Roosevelt Room and the restrooms. Not the one I sometimes shared with the vice president, but the single men's and women's restrooms situated midway between the Oval Office and upper press. Brian, always dressed impeccably, was the unofficial arbiter of style around the West Wing. Officially, he was charged with ensuring that the president's in-house events ran smoothly, and that the decorum, from the Oval Office to the East Room, was upheld. "Jesus, who's been in the men's room recently?" he called out, swinging the door open like Kramer bursting onto set. "Disgusting." It was becoming a thing. Brian was determined to root out the West Wing pooper. Schultz sauntered in next, grossed out. "I have a flag about the men's restroom," he said, which sent Brian sprinting back into the hallway to get a handle on things. A flag was something that could become a thing, and a thing was code for a problem. And when a flag became enough of a thing, there was only one person to call. Eric Schultz was the White House fixer. He relished, indeed encouraged, the inevitable comparison to Kerry Washington's character on the TV drama Scandal, the male version of Olivia Pope. Truth is, he was talented enough for it to be so. But for those of us who dealt with him daily, we knew him as a lovable combination of Dwight Schrute from The Office, infused with the wiles of Dan Egan from Veep. In fact, the folks who worked at Veep met with Schultz before their show aired to nail the eccentricities of Washington's elite. Schultz rushed through personal pleasantries so perfunctorily that they weren't pleasant at all. He loved perks and was uncomfortable around babies. Like many Washingtonians, he could be transactional by nature, but he had a good heart, and he was as gifted and sophisticated a press person as you could find anywhere. When things went haywire, the White House often turned to Shultz. He would know what to do, which is why he was a regular member of the red teams that popped up in preparation for complicated rollouts or in the wake of pseudo-scandals. He had the right combination of drive, discretion, and decency, mixed with an entertaining flair for the dramatic. Noticing the open box of candy, Shultz continued, calling out, "Did I get screwed out of snacks again?" Throughout his tenure, Eric was known for simultaneously trolling for treats around the West Wing and for his fruitless pursuit of a personal trainer across D.C. who would be willing to put up with his hectic schedule. Vels, a persnickety press assistant famous for his eye rolls reflecting a thinly veiled sense of superiority and for overseeing the communications intern's side. "They're from the interns." "And what am I, chopped liver?" Shultz demanded. "Can you even name an intern, Shultz?" Hallie asked. "No, but that's because none has ever made an impression on me," he replied, with his signature head swivel and a quick check of his watch, a nervous tick. "Shultzy, I was one of your interns," Vels reminded him. This warranted a major eye roll. Without missing a beat, and with the knack for spin that made him so valuable, Shultz retorted, "And I don't want to take all of the credit, but look how well you turned out." "There it is," Desiree interjected, "a white man trying to claim credit for a minority's success." Vels's mother is from Thailand. Desiree was my deskmate and good friend, though neither of us would admit it. She started with the Obamas as an intern very early on and was a standout member of the advance team before moving into her role as wrangler and later as a special assistant in the West Wing. An African-American woman my age, Desiree had a habit of turning her quick wit on me. Upper press was a diverse work environment, though no thanks to me. For a few years, aside from the press secretary, I was the only white guy working there. And for the duration of my time, women outnumbered men. Diversity in our workplace never seemed forced. It felt organic, like the pool of talent drawn to President Obama came from every background imaginable. Our differences were our strength, but they also provided plenty of opportunities to call out one another, to erupt in mock indignation, or to have a little fun at one another's or our own expense. There was an openness to talking about race in the office, and there were many jokes we could all get into comfortably, but there were some we couldn't. And Desiree was particularly skilled at screeching the conversation to a halt when I overstepped, or, more frequently, when she could pretend I did for the good of the room. I was the foil, after all. "Yes, Shultz, do you really feel comfortable taking any of the credit?" I asked. "I'd say that's red zone material, right, Desiree?" Red zone is what somebody would inevitably announce when things were going south in upper press, when we were veering into awkward or potentially offensive territory. Now, given that I was considered a repeat offender, Desiree kept a post-it note between us titled, "Red Zone." She tallied, often unfairly to my mind, each time I crossed the verbal line, and I was desperate to get somebody other than myself a tally. "No, Pat, this is one thing that you, as a straight, white, privileged man, do not get to be in charge of. You don't dictate tallies to me. In fact, that in and of itself is Red Zone." Shultz, foraging through the food, ignored us both and turned to Hallie. "I have something for your boss. It's timely. So if you could get me a few minutes, that'd be great. Okay, thanks." He's in the Situation Room, and this better not be about Louie. "Totes. T-Y-T-Y, Shultz shouted to Hallie as he dashed down into his small office in lower press, donut hole in hand. Louie is Shultz's dog. Bo and Sonny, the first dogs, liked to rustle around what we called the burn bags. They looked like trash bags, after all, and we threw a lot of uneaten food from the press into our regular trash cans. These freestanding brown paper bags with burnt orange lines zigging and zagging around them were strewn throughout all of our offices. They were meant to collect our work-relevant papers, especially anything that was sensitive or classified. When we ran out of use for a particular document, record, or page of notes, we'd burn bag it. That was a misnomer, however, as the glorified trash bags weren't all sent off to be scorched into oblivion. Some turned into a catch-all for relevant and semi-relevant documents that we didn't know how to discard. The two Portuguese water dogs had free rein of the place, bounding up and down the stairs, barking their way through the outer Oval Office and into upper press. During the day when the first family wasn't in the residence, Dale, a longtime trusted employee of the White House grounds, helped to mind them. As head groundskeeper, he was always on the move, which made him a perfect fit for helping to tire out the dogs. Sometimes they got loose, though, without Dale close behind, and went foraging for food. Beau had done just that, inspecting the trash can by my desk, sniffing the remnants of a chocolate freedom, an extravagant chocolate lava cake with soft-serve vanilla ice cream in a cup on the side, prepared by the White House Navy mess. Upon ordering one for himself after his famous interview with President Obama on the internet talk show Between Two Ferns, comedian Zach Galifianakis asked if the chocolate freedom was named after Obama himself. It wasn't. Rumor had it that it was made of French chocolate, and in the madness surrounding freedom fries and France's opposition to the invasion of Iraq, the George W. Bush White House deemed it the chocolate freedom. We looked for any excuse to order one. Somebody's last day, a birthday, whatever. I lunged for Beau the instant I saw him getting too close to the freedom, determined not to be the staffer responsible for killing America's first dog. Schultz popped in as Beau was leaving, sans chocolate. How come I can't bring Louie into the West Wing? Because you were never elected president of the United States, Schultz, Bobby reminded him. I liked when Schultz bore the brunt of the office's sharp sarcasm and acerbic wit. Usually I was the primary and, most would say, easiest target. But Schultz's misadventures were often a nice distraction for my office mates. Your boss still isn't back? I'm sorry, Schultz, Hallie said. Jay's still in the sit room. He's getting briefed on Syria, but I'm sure your problem is just as important. I was ready to lay into Schultz, to ask specifically what he needed, and make fun of him. Surely it couldn't be as important as Syria, and, more likely, it was a ridiculous request or pet project. But before I could, Jay walked in, back from the Situation Room. Matt followed behind from lower press. Hey, you guys ever notice who Pat looks like? Jay asked. What movies are out right now? I wondered to myself. Maybe he had seen a movie star the night before who reminded him of me. Who would it be? I was kind of excited to find out. Bashar al-Assad. That didn't sound right. Whoa, 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 wait a minute, I said. Bobby pulled up a photo of the Syrian dictator. Jay, Matt, and Josh gathered around. Holy shit, you're right, said Matt, delighted at yet another opportunity to mock me. When a problematic story hits the press, there's an immediate decision to be made, in upper and lower press. Respond, let it be, or wait and see. If you think the story is a blip, that it will wash away within the next news cycle, it's best not to give it extra oxygen and more life. Better to leave it alone, to die out in the crowded news environment all by itself. Now, if you think the story has legs, that its impact will be more meaningful and destructive, it's best to respond quickly. I knew immediately that Jay's joke was a problematic narrative, and I could tell by the response of my upper press colleagues that it wasn't burning itself out anytime soon. It had legs, so to speak. I took the first approach. I responded immediately. A flat-out denial. No way, I declared. I am far better looking than he is. This is a joke, right? I can kind of see it, Hallie added sheepishly. That's when I knew this would truly stick, and that I was in trouble. Hallie was usually protective of me, quick to give me the benefit of the doubt and play good cop. You're like the handsome version, she added, trying to make me feel better. Much more handsome, I insisted. You know he's also a brutal dictator, Bobby said. Okay, can we at least say I'm the handsome, non-dictator version of Assad, I pleaded, just hoping for a correction at this point. Nope, sorry, Bashar, Jay said, laughing all the way into his office. Beau scampered back to my desk as Jay closed the door, but somebody shooed him away. The first dog shouldn't be associated with a ruthless dictator. My Uncle Bob knew all about the power of presidential pets. In the mid-1990s, he volunteered every Wednesday in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, where he read, sorted, and coded mail for President Bill Clinton. There was one permanent staffer in the group, and the rest, like my Uncle Bob, were volunteers, teachers, police officers, veterans, just hoping to help out. After a few hours of reading and cataloging, the volunteers would grab a bite to eat at a local bar. Then my Uncle Bob would drive back up to Philadelphia, arriving home around 2 in the morning. The trip was worth it to him. He loved the idea of playing a part, however small, at the White House. Still, he sometimes needed a reminder about what he was really doing there. So he approached the permanent staffer and asked him if he ever got to see the president. I saw President Carter once, the man said with a smile. Oh, brother, Uncle Bob thought. This did not portend much of a chance for his next ask, but he plowed ahead anyway. Well, it's really cool here, and I love it. But do you think President Clinton might ever come up here, say hello? I think it might mean a lot to the group. No, I don't think so, the staffer responded. And just like that, Bob went back to work. Worth the shot, he thought, as he continued chipping away at the pile of mail in front of him. By the end of next Wednesday's session, my uncle had largely forgotten his request and was just happy to be involved, when the staffer asked for everyone's attention. Excuse me, everybody. Before heading out the door to their usual spot for late-night food and a story or two, the group turned back intently. I have some exciting news. Now he really had Uncle Bob's attention. And I know Bob's going to be particularly happy about this. We have a very special guest coming next week. The other volunteers looked at Bob, sharing smiles. He was practically bursting at the seams. My uncle adjusted his tie, ready to make a quick statement of his own after the staffer completed his announcement. My request got to the president, he thought, astounded. Socks the cat will be stopping by. You would think they might have been disappointed, but you would be wrong. The group of volunteers cheered, a high five or two slapped out, and they departed for the evening, excited for what the next week would bring. Everybody dressed a little bit better than usual the following Wednesday. Uncle Bob wore his newest tie. Everybody brought a camera. They were distracted reading letters that night, shifting anxiously in their seats. Finally, the door creaked open, and a young female staffer from the West Wing entered with a crate. It was the same kind of crate Uncle Bob used to drag his cat to the shore in the back of his sedan. The young woman popped open the cage, and the critter crawled out, black and white with green eyes, just like they had seen on TV. The woman sat on a chair with socks on her lap, like Santa Claus. The volunteers assembled into an orderly line, ready to crouch down and get their photograph taken with the famous feline. It was ridiculous, but the team was hypnotized. Socks was something, anything, a tangible piece of history. He was the president's cat. The room was buzzing even after Socks had long departed. But as the afterglow burned off, Uncle Bob realized the whole thing was absurd. That didn't stop him from recounting the story repeatedly. In fact, I remember as a little kid on the way to first or second grade hearing my mom excitedly retell Uncle Bob's close encounter with the first cat. I used to brag about Uncle Bob's Socks visit at recess, probably to Stephanie back in grade school. Now I was chasing Bo out of my trash can, passing him on the colonnade, and staging Bo TRs, first dog drop-bys for special guests or volunteers, not unlike the Socks the Cat fiasco. Another reminder, albeit a fairer, less imposing one than Obama himself, that I wasn't in any old office, and that despite the remarkably familiar nature of our interoffice dynamics, we weren't pushing paper at Dunder Mifflin in Scranton. Could you imagine if the press knew that Syria's dictator was sitting 30 feet from the president? Bobby asked me with a glint behind his glasses. No matter how embarrassed I felt, as I continued to get labeled as the doppelganger for one of the world's most evil men, I knew that I was someplace special. Chapter 3, Lower Press. Where the press is free and every man able to read, all is safe. Thomas Jefferson. Peter Vels was stationed temporarily in Lower Press. We needed him on the front lines, fending off the deluge of requests rushing in from reporters. They were coming in fast, sliding quickly through the blue door from the briefing room. One journalist seemed more agitated than the next. Everybody wanted a word, an explanation. It was a time of great stress in the West Wing. It was time for our annual holiday party. Returning from the brief Thanksgiving break at the end of November always proved one of those "I can't believe I work here" moments. Year after year, as I would walk into the West Wing lobby, fresh from home in Philadelphia, the fragrance of the newly cut Christmas trees and looping garland would hit me. Christmas at the White House. It was hard not to get into the spirit. Volunteers from across the country, mostly moms in aprons and holiday sweaters, scurried from room to room, decorating the People's House. Like Manhattan's Rockefeller Center in December, anticipation was in the air, a keenness to mark the year's end. Thanksgiving was an appetizer. A real break was in sight. Soon the president would be wheels up for Hawaii. But first we had to get through the 3-week slog. Washington would struggle to finish its business, and the White House would host two parties every day, For press, representatives, celebrities, staff, or stakeholders, a DC term for a bunch of people of differing degrees of bearing, each afternoon and evening. We in the press office and the communication shop were responsible for two of those parties, one primarily for print reporters and the other mostly for broadcast television reporters. As was the case every previous year, space for our receptions was tight. We couldn't accommodate everyone. Still, every member of the press wanted an invite. They were entitled to it, they thought, and never ceased to be shocked that there might not be space. It didn't matter that some of them hadn't been on the White House's 18-acre campus since the previous December, when they'd done the same bidding they were now doing with Vels, pleading for an invite and excoriating the powers that dared restrict their holiday spirit. Schultz was situated comfortably behind his sliding door in lower press, but still within earshot of the constant conversations between Vels and the press, the wheeling and dealing for a spot, pretty please, to the White House holiday party. Schultz, like the rest of us, was just glad he wasn't the one dealing directly with the invites. Vels was the man for the job. He had a process. He had three interns helping, sorting photo cards on the floor, alphabetizing invites. He created a sense of order in handling the dependably pesky press, who had a knack for posing questions others might have been too embarrassed to ask. The debacle was predictable, and some of the meltdowns memorable. Am I not important enough to get an invite? My job depends on going. Can you please add me? Do you know who I am? And the thing that really separated reporters from the rest of us, they always remembered to follow up. Like a skilled fencer, Vels swatted down most requests adroitly, quickly consulting his behemoth color-coded Excel spreadsheet. Invited, not invited, waitlisted, next. One notable last-minute guest who had been waitlisted and then approved, a card-carrying member of Old Washington's elite, tried to push his luck. He had been approved as a special case, invited on the agreed-upon precondition that he not receive a picture with the president. That's because POTUS and FLOTUS stood for more than 300 photos nearly every night in December, as the parade of holiday parties wore on. We refused to add further to the president's pain by tacking on any more photos at the 11th hour. But this guest decided to sneak past three interns and into the photo line, where Vels stopped him. Just one quick picture, please, the man pleaded, his date by his side. Where I would have broken, Vels didn't even bend. You were invited by Eric Schultz on the condition you wouldn't receive a photo. He told you this, correct? Yes, but Vels sternly cut the man off again. No, unfortunately, I can't allow it. You're free to enjoy the party upstairs, but we won't be able to provide a photo. Vels turned away. On to more business. Additional fires to put out. I was impressed. Vels thrived in this environment. His natural ability to gatekeep was part of what made him a good press wrangler. Schultz, known for cutting last-minute deals, wasn't as adept at turning people away. He scooted up to Vels. That was a DC VIP you just dismissed. There goes my invite to his legendary brunch. Vels didn't bat an eye. He'd been dealing with requests from important people, usually self-proclaimed, for 2 months. Reporters sometimes tried to play the race card, or the favorites card, but Vels stood firm. He would say, I can offer you a White House Christmas card. Truth is, we weren't responsible for the bulk of the invites to our parties. We let the newspapers and networks decide who they wanted included on the invite lists, precisely so we wouldn't be perceived as playing favorites, or for rewarding positive coverage. All we had was a number, dictated to us by the social office. We told NBC how many people it could invite, and the network gave us a list of names. So too for Fox News, The Washington Post, and the rest. Somehow, that never seemed to sink in for the reporters who flocked to lower press in the lead-up to the receptions each year. That's because they knew we did cut drug deals on the side, adding a few friendly faces and longtime reporters or crew members, the lower-level folks with whom we actually worked, but who were left off of their bosses' lists in lieu of media executives from New York and Los Angeles. They hoped that they might be the recipients of one of those side deals, too. We were all dependent on one another, after all. Depending on the story of the day, or moment for that matter, the press corps can be your ally or your adversary. There are the usual suspects, the TV anchor who thinks he's a budding hotshot, the breathless TV reporter always desperate for just 2 seconds of your time, the grizzled still photographer who knows more about the place than anybody. They wanted the scoop, and we wanted to shape the message, which fused a relationship that could be mutually beneficial or detrimental, but always dependent. The White House holiday reception served as a kind of culmination of that year's mutual dependence, a night to let loose, imbibe the boozy eggnog, marvel at the tree in the blue room, or talk in the East Room about things other than pool sprays, embargoes, and background quotes. It wasn't all fun, though. The social office required that members of the communications team staff portions of our own parties. Vels typically tasked me with the photo card table for an hour or two. That's where reporters and their dates picked up name cards just before heading into the diplomatic reception room, dip room, for their photo with the president and the first lady. Most of the riffraff had been snuffed out by the time people reached our table in the basement cross hall of the main mansion, marked by its long, piercing red carpet and arched marble walls. One photographer did come close, though. She sneaked a second guest into the party, her newborn child. Now, she didn't smuggle the infant in through the metal detector unnoticed, but no staffer to this point was willing to stand up to the mini party crasher. Vels didn't blink. He made her choose between her stowaway baby and her appropriately RSVP'd adult guest. She chose her husband. I don't know who she left her baby with. Mercifully, Vels handled her before she made it to me at the card table. So my only concern was remembering names, or bullshitting my way through interactions until the reporter's name popped into my mind, and I reached for the appropriate card. There were plenty of instances when I knew I just wasn't going to remember, no matter how much small talk we did. So I'd put my head down, pretend not to see who was next in line, and shout, "Last name?" The reporter would say his or her name, and I'd look up with a smile. "Oh, hey man, didn't see you there," I'd say, handing over the card. "Enjoy your photo." I was gearing up for my turn at the table. The party had just begun. Photos would start soon with the president and the first lady, when I saw one of my newest coworkers, a charming, smart woman named Crystal, in the cross hall. Crystal was the rarest of White House assistants. She never got rattled and rarely showed frustration. She was savvy in the best way. I headed to her as I scarfed down one of the White House's chocolate cookies baked to look like Beau, which was sort of ironic, I think, given that Beau could have died eating one. There was always a line for those in the state dining room, and I knew to snag them early, and I needed one tonight. Our receptions were on weekday nights, and this weekday had been particularly difficult. As usual, Washington was still struggling to get its business done. Congress was breaking toward another week of brinksmanship, threatening to shut down the government once again. It wasn't a banner day in the West Wing. We had cracked into the aforementioned Russian reporter's vodka and were sustaining ourselves largely on Doug's famous chocolate pretzels. Nobody was in the mood for a party. I tried to lighten things as I reached Crystal. "Hey, don't take this in any kind of a way," I prefaced, already provoking her unease. I should have stopped right there. Sentences that start this way don't end well, but I continued. "Do you watch Black-ish on ABC? That very moment, our nation's first African-American president strode in, exhausted. We made eye contact, and he shook his head. He couldn't have heard me, I thought. Even if he had, there was nothing wrong with my question, right? It was totally normal banter between colleagues. I loved the show and wanted to see what Crystal, a young black woman, thought. Oh, who was I kidding? I looked like an ass. I was always curious. What must the president have thought, walking around the White House and seeing 25-year-olds essentially running the place? What would Americans have thought if they knew that terrifying, wonderful truth? That their hopes and dreams rested in the hands of a bunch of 20-somethings. Mostly, I'm sure the president was proud, impressed by our professionalism, rejuvenated by our energy, grateful for our optimism. But that general sense of pride had to be punctured at least weekly by interactions like these. Reminders that, yep, you're the leader of the free world, but you've got a bunch of millennials who actually make the place go. Another good impression, I thought to myself as the president turned the corner to his elevator for the two-story ride home, tired after a long day of work with the weight of an impending government shutdown bearing on him. He would have just a few minutes for dinner with his family before heading right back down to take 300 photos with strangers. "What kind of question is that?" Crystal shot back the moment POTUS was out of sight. "You been having some of that eggnog or what?" She feigned exasperation. I begged her not to tell Desiree. Crystal had a superb knack for deadpan humor. "Do I go around asking you what happened on How I Met Your Mother last night?" Many hundreds of journalists claim to be White House reporters, but there are maybe 100 regulars who make up the true press corps. The reporters, photographers, producers, camera women and men, audio crews, and radio correspondents whom we saw day in and day out on the north lawn of the White House and in the West Wing. They keep watch over the place, dutifully monitoring the goings-on, witnessing and participating in history. The White House is their office too. In fact, President Obama, or any president for that matter, couldn't walk between his office and his residence without passing the briefing room. Situated between the West Wing and the People's House, the briefing room's location is a reminder of the crucial role of the press as intermediary between the president and the public. We hold briefings there, but it's also a workspace for reporters on deadline and a location from which TV journalists broadcast their reports. Pebble Beach, named for its once gravelly, muddy outdoor mess, is a collection of tented press stand-up locations where television reporters film their daily dispatches, often for the nightly or morning news shows. But traffic flows to and from the area at all hours of the day as reporters, producers, and camera crews try to keep up with the all-day demands of MSNBC, Fox, and CNN. It was a visible reminder that the business had changed, that the media were evolving, trying to keep up with the increasing demand for news, or what passes for it, in the attempt to fill the void. When I first started in the West Wing, Pebble Beach was obscured by a massive, mysterious hole in front of the main lobby, where the driveway used to be. The hole required a temporary elevated walkway to and from Pebble Beach and the main entrance for the press and staffers at the Northwest Gate on Pennsylvania Avenue. The moat-like mystery hole, given its prime location under the feet of dozens of reporters as they made their way to and from work each day, was the cause of much speculation, especially among the press. The General Services Administration, the agency responsible for managing government buildings, provided a bland statement about renovations to the West Wing's standard systems. Electrical, for instance. That take was met with healthy skepticism among the press. Frankly, most of us who watched the hole grow wider and deeper for more than a year weren't buying it either. Not when giant hunks of concrete were lowered into the abyss right outside our windows. We figured it was security-related, but knew better than to ask. Like anything having to do with the protection of the place, it was beyond my pay grade. I just hoped there might be room for me in what I assumed was an apocalypse-ready bunker. If our space in the West Wing is tight, the press space is tighter still. Reporters are stationed behind and beneath the press briefing room. 5, 6, sometimes 7 members of an outlet, the Associated Press or CBS News, for instance, squeezed into booths no more than 10 feet deep that are separated by slender glass doors. In the midst of the crammed glass compartments, there's an open space where a metal sign hangs from the ceiling. This is Stills Country. The Stills are a rotating crew of still photographers, a cast of characters who range in age from late 20s to early 60s. By and large, these are the living historians of the White House. Some have taken thousands of flights on Air Force One, working for the bulk of their lives over a number of presidencies in the bubble. They're from the New York Times, the Associated Press, the Reuters News Agency, Agency France Press, and a revolving group of additional outlets from across the country and around the world. They move like a pack, and when it's just men, they verge on the vulgar. They're as dedicated to having a good time as they are to doing a good job, and they make the place more fun. Stills don't take pictures, they make pictures. And they adhere to a strict code of conduct among themselves. Yes, they'll jostle for position on the rope line, but they respect that their peers need to make the shot as well, and they'll help a photographer if he or she is in need. Making space, advocating for one another, working as a team. It was all a part of the code. There are infamous stories, mostly from the distant past, about what happened when a photographer or some other reporter in the pack broke the code. One of my favorite photographers, a genteel older man with a sweet affect and shy charisma, was said to have opened a competitor's luggage during an overseas trip and relieved himself on the contents of the bag. Nobody quite remembers why he supposedly did it, but all seem to understand the frustration that can build over days, weeks, sometimes months on the road. Fortunately, the crew had evolved by the time Obama took office, graduating to harmless pranks when I met them, such as teasing newer reporters into thinking big news was just around the corner. To a new press wrangler, though, a trustworthy still photographer can be a godsend, as a few were to me. I often looked to Doug, the bald, friendly leader of the pack, for advice. As I was still getting my footing, he'd give a subtle nod, flagging for me that something was amiss. A Secret Service agent was blocking the shot, for instance, or a newer reporter was creeping too close to the president. Most of all, the Stills are a remarkably talented bunch, and their work regularly lands on the front pages of the nation's largest newspapers, above the fold. We trusted the photographers. They were the nucleus of the president's press pool. Press pool was a term, like POTUS on my first day, that I had heard thrown around but never truly understood until I became a wrangler, tasked with herding the pool from place to place and country to country. There were variations for in-town pool versus out-of-town travel pool, but the basic gist is this. A group of reporters, camera crew, and photographers traveled everywhere with the president, from foreign trips and domestic rallies to rounds of golf and birthday dinners in D.C. There were 5 stills, 4 writers, a radio reporter, a sound tech, a camera person, and a producer. The pool, established during the Eisenhower administration, was born out of simple logistics. Not everyone who wanted to cover the president could. There's not enough space, and most outlets can't afford the expense of doing so in the first place. So this group of reporters pools its talent, time, and resources to cover the president continuously. Its purpose is straightforward. Report and record what's happening with the president. Sometimes they record real history. Swearings in, papal visits, the State of the Union. But more often, they're around in case. When there are date nights, parent-teacher conferences, midnight arrivals of Marine One, their purpose is understood and unspoken and often grim. Truth is, the pool is around in case something goes wrong around the world or in the president's protective bubble. After all, any picture of the president could be the last. That's when they're really recording history, those flashes of intrigue or tragedy that play in our public conversation for years. The pool was there when President Kennedy was shot in Dallas. It's how a devastated nation and my distraught Nana were kept informed as their president fought for his life. So too, the pool fed footage to the country in the aftermath of the 1981 assassination attempt on President Ronald Reagan in Washington. It's how we know of President George W. Bush's immediate reaction upon learning that we were under attack on September 11, 2001. The pool, including then-Time correspondent Jay Carney and favorite photographer Doug, was aboard Air Force One, the only plane in the sky, as America considered its next move. A similar moment, a stark change of course, could replay itself at any time. But that was easy to forget while sitting in the food court at JBA, short for Joint Base Andrews, the U.S. Air Force facility where the president's planes were stored, and where we departed on countless domestic and overseas trips. But when the weekend rolled around, assuming there wasn't snow on the ground, there was a good chance we were headed to JBA for a different reason. It was a wrangler's worst nightmare. Obama loved to golf. We in the press office often said he just enjoyed the chance to take a walk outside. That was the company line, and it was certainly true. But to use a frequent Obama-ism, what is also true is that the man had become somewhat obsessed with the game. Many weekends he'd try to squeeze in a round or two, and naturally, the pool was always along for the ride. I would sit with them in the food court for 5 hours while the president played. It was the bane of whichever wrangler had weekend duty, especially for me. I'm an avid golfer, and I would much rather have been on the links than watching the pool scarf down junk food at creaky cafeteria tables. One of the producers who frequented the pool liked to try his hand at eating around the world, like at Epcot and Disney World, except with Taco Bell, Anthony's Pizza and Pasta, a Burger King, a knockoff cheesesteak place, and a fish stick stand. He'd pile his tray high, one item from each spot, and dig in, until I got word from the Secret Service agent stationed with us that the president was on the 16th green. That's when we would head to the pool vans to link back up with the motorcade. The print reporter would send a note to the rest of the White House correspondents anytime the pool or president made a move. They were called pool reports and went something like this. The pool has moved to the vans, the president evidently wrapping up his nearly 5-hour round of golf. That was about the extent of insight we wanted the pool to have. Golf was one of those in-case circumstances. If something went wrong, the pool was there. If not, I was to keep everyone at a reasonable distance. We didn't like footage of the president playing golf. A duffed chip or missed putt could draw out trite, stretched analogies to a failed policy or flawed rollout from a bored press pool. And if he striped one right down the middle? Well, then why is the president so good at golf? He was clearly playing too much golf and had too much time to practice his drives. Most of all, the right-wing media just didn't approve of the president playing golf. And the far right-wing media personalities more specifically didn't approve of this president playing golf.